morning, members. Thank you very much for making it to this meeting this morning. As you know, this is a very important meeting because we have to begin the process of identifying the most suitable person for the position of public protector. And obviously, the actual date when we do the interviews, we would have to go through the process of ensuring that the public is involved in the process of nominating the suitable people. And this meeting is primarily about looking at the average and finalizing our program going forward. So, members, what I have requested the secretary to organize is to get a presentation from the Justice Cluster to present to present on fit and proper, because I think that's going to be one of the areas that is going to be critical, as well as all legislative related matters. Bonani, I'm not sure if the person will be doing the presentation is here. Okay. Or Christine, you're going to do it. Okay. All right, Christine will start, and then the legal advisor will follow. And after that, we will take questions. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Christine Softone. I'm the Conflict Advisor with the Procurement Justice, and I'm the Conflict Advisor on this ad hoc committee as well. The chairperson asked me just to prepare a very short background presentation on the public protector, looking at the mandate and roles, and then also looking primarily at the actual appointment process and the selection criteria. So it's a relatively descriptive presentation. I just want to apologize from the outset. My voice is not the loudest of voices, and I've got a cold, so I can hardly hear myself. So if I sort of dip, then please just let me know. So where I want to start is with the public protector as a Chapter 9 institution. These Chapter 9 institutions were established to support our constitutional democracy. They are to act independently. And my point that I want to make around this is that other countries have ombuds, and they also have national human rights institutions, but our country is unique in that we've actually placed and established these institutions within our constitution. And this provides them with a unique status and an indication of how important they are to our constitutional democracy. And the reason for this was that drafters of our constitution acknowledged the profound respect of the apartheid government state for the human rights of its citizens. And these Chapter 9 institutions were established to restore the credibility of the state in the eyes of the public and ensure that our constitutional democracy flourishes and that there's a continued respect for the rule of law and that the state itself becomes more open and responsive to its citizens. I'm not going to speak to every slide. I don't think it's necessary. Then just moving on to the public protector's constitutional mandate. The public protector was established or is established to ensure government's accountability and to provide remedies for maladministration and abuse of authority. To do this, the public protector is empowered to investigate, report on, and suggest remedial action for a wide range of wrongdoings in the public administration. Section 1821 of the Constitution provides as follows. The public protector has the power, as regulated by national legislation, A, to investigate conduct in state affairs when the public administration in any sphere of government has alleged or suspected to be improper or to result in an impropriety or prejudice, to report on any conduct and to take any appropriate remedial action. And Section 1822 provides the public protector has additional powers and functions prescribed by national legislation. And there's a whole lot of legislation that assigns powers to the public protector, but the two key ones are obviously the Public Protector Act of 1994, which has been amended since, and also the Executive Members Ethics Act of 1998. So the Public Protector Act empowers the public protector to investigate on his or her own initiative or a complaint any alleged maladministration in connection with the federal government. And I'm reading this article because it's quite wordy. Abuse or unjustifiable exercise of power or unfair, discourteous or other improper conduct or undue delay, improper or unlawful enrichment or receipt of any improper advantage or promise of such enrichment or advantage by a person as a result of an act or omission, and any act or omission which results in improper prejudice. So as you can see, this is the public protector has wide powers within the public administration to really to redress wrongdoing. The public protector has got wide powers. She or she can issue subpoenas, and they have powers of search and seizure. The public protector also has powers in terms of to investigate corruption and also to redress any kind of to address protective disclosure, so it's whistleblowing powers. And just to move on, in terms of the Executive Ethics Members Ethics Act, the public protector is empowered to investigate any complaint by an MP or Premier or MPL or the President of an alleged breach of conduct and code of ethics, governing the conduct of the members of the Cabinet, the Minister, Deputy Minister, and members of the Executive Councils of provinces. I won't go through all the other acts where she or he has powers. And just a quick fact around the public protector South Africa. The public protector is a person, but there's also an institution called Public Protector South Africa. The PPSA has a budget of 262 million for the 2016-17 financial year. The current staff component is 269 members of staff, of which 146 are investigators and 39 are assistant investigators. This translates to about 90 cases per investigator. And then alternative dispute resolution services and investigative services are provided in 20 service centres around the country. And then the stats, the 2014-15 annual reports gives us that just over 20,000 cases were finalised, 2,700 cases were referred with advice to other institutions. 49% of the complaints were upheld. Public protector published 19 formal reports, as she had one own initiative investigation concerning SASA. Okay, just moving quick on to the appointment process. The appointment process is set out in terms of the Constitution, section 193 of the Constitution. And basically, the President must appoint public protector whenever it becomes necessary for a non-renewable term of 7 years on the recommendation of the National Assembly. The National Assembly initiates the process. The matter is referred to an ad hoc or to a committee. It doesn't need to be an ad hoc committee. It just needs to be a committee of the National Assembly. And this mandated committee must then nominate a candidate to the National Assembly. The National Assembly will pass a resolution to support the candidate or recommending the candidate. And that resolution must, and this is really important, must be supported by a vote of 60% of the members of the National Assembly. And then the final point in the Constitution is involvement of civil society may be provided for in terms of Section 59(1) of the Constitution. And Section 59(1) refers to the facilitation of public involvement in the legislative and other processes of Parliament, or the National Assembly, sorry, and also the conduct of meetings in open. In terms of selection criteria, it's also in Section 193 of the Constitution, which provides that the public protector must be a South African citizen. He or she must be a fit and proper person to hold a particular office, and our legal advisor will expand on what fit and proper means, and then also comply with any other requirements prescribed by national legislation. And relevant national legislation is the Public Protector Act, Section 1A. And here, Section 1A3 sets out the criteria. Again, the person must be South African citizen, must be fit and proper. And here, the qualifications are the person can be a judge of the High Court. so she can be admitted and admitted advocate or attorney who has practiced for 10 or more years. If a person who is qualified to be admitted as an advocate or attorney and has taught law in a university, so a legal academic, again for 10 years, for at least 10 years. A person who has specialized knowledge or experience in the administration of justice or in public administration, public finance, for again for a period of at least 10 years, or a person who has a cumulative period of at least 10 years, a combination of the above, not the judge of the High Court, but other criteria. Oh, and the last one, I'm sorry, I missed this off, a person who has been an MP for at least 10 years, MP or MPL. And then just to give some kind of background, we've had three previous public, well, we've got three previous public detectives. First one was Advocate Selby Zahra, who was appointed in 1995. The second one was Advocate Lawrence Lashwana, who was appointed in 2002. And obviously the last, our present one is Advocate Tuli Madamsida. All of the above have legal qualifications. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christian. Could I kindly call upon Ms. Nathan Chenyane to make a presentation on fit and proper? Then I'll take questions from the members. Over to you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Good morning to you, Chair, and to honorable members. Chair, I have not slighted the legal opinion because copies have been circulated to members and it's a very short document. With your leave, I will just proceed and present from the document unless... Thank you, Chair. Chair, we received an urgent request from your office to prepare a short memorandum on the principle of for future proper person to occupy the Office of Public Protector. And we subsequently proceeded to prepare the short opinion memorandum that is before members.
Chair. What is the document title here? Because we can't find it. I don't have a copy. Well, that's fine, we can proceed.
Thank you, Chair and Member. Chair, we then proceeded to prepare a short memorandum that is before members. We haven't in this memorandum so looked into the mandate, but unfortunately our colleague here has presented on the mandate and as well as the appointment procedure of the public protector. We simply confined it to the legal interpretation of the principle of fit and proper person to occupy that office. Chair, that the principle of fit and proper person to occupy the office of the public protector is outlined in the Constitution as well as in legislation. Section 193 of the Constitution set up this requirement. It is again repeated in Section 1, capital letter A of the Public Protector Act. It comes across as a very stringent requirement in law, Chairperson. However, it is not defined, neither is it described in legislation. However, quite fortunately, the courts have gone to length in interpreting the principle of fit and proper person in the context of various professions, including the legal profession, or mainly in the legal profession, possibly because they are quite litigious people and they've approached the courts to try and get an understanding of what exactly fit and proper person means. This has assisted us, Chair, to understand this in the context of your question, and we have cited in this memorandum a couple of those cases shortened versions for clear understanding of this presentation. The first case of this, Chair, the legal scholars have interpreted this principle of fit and proper person and have concluded that it serves as a warranty given to the public that a person occupying an office as important as that of the public protector will act ethically. The burden of proof that a person is fit and proper to hold an office is rested on the person applying to occupy that office. It is commonly accepted that in order to be fit and proper, a person must show integrity, reliability, and honesty, as these are the characteristics which could affect the relationship between the office concerned as well as the public. The first case I'd like to cite for our people's share is the case of Ngwenya versus the Society of Advocates in Pretoria. The applicant in this case had applied to be admitted as an advocate, but quite unfortunately he pleaded on the one hand that he had been wrongfully convicted of a crime, and on the other, that he had since reformed. The court argued that the reformation can begin only when a person acknowledges that he has committed a wrongful act. And therefore, the applicant's character references supporting the statement that he has reformed were irreconcilable with his allegation that he has been wrongfully convicted. The court therefore concluded, Chair, that if the references were to be true, his statement that he had been wrongfully convicted was untrue, which in turn meant that he was not a fit and proper person to be admitted as an advocate. The court in this matter emphasized the issue of honesty, Chair, that if the statement was true by the references, and him saying that he was wrongfully convicted as being untrue, and therefore there was a level of dishonesty, and therefore the fit and proper person, the standards had not been met in this instance. Similarly, the case of Machaka in the Northern Gauteng Provincial Division, the applicant applied to the court that the fit and proper person standard violated the right to dignity, quality, and right to be subjected to cruel, not to be subjected to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, as well as the right to choose one's trade, occupation, or profession. Again, consistently, the court in this instance rejected the claim, as well as the idea that membership of the legal profession should not be subjected to character screening of the person involved. The court specifically said that the character screening prevented the right to freely choose one's profession from being abused by criminally minded attorneys. Again, here, the court emphasizes that the whole principle of fit and proper is about screening the character of the person to fit the standard of honesty, integrity, as well as reliability. Again, in the case of Babin in the Supreme Court of Appeal, where attorney had stolen money by conniving with an insurance company and paid the profits to himself instead of the client, he then was taken to court and challenged on the issue of on the standard of fit and proper practice law. In deciding this matter, the Supreme Court of Appeal said he was not fit and proper person to practice law because honesty, reliability, and integrity are expected of an attorney. Recently, sharing the measures in the matter of the Democratic Alliance versus the President of the Republic of South Africa and others, popularly known as the Simelane matter, the Constitutional Court pronounced itself on this matter, and it said, the decision by the President to appoint the National Director of Public Prosecutions, which had been decided by the Constitutional Court and taken to the by the Supreme Court of Appeal and taken to the Constitutional Court confirmation of being set aside, the court said, the National Director of Public Prosecutions must be fit and proper, and this constitutes a jurisdictional fact capable of objective ascertainment. When the matter was taken to court, the court said, the opinion in relation to the fit and proper may differ. However, the difference of opinion does not render the opinion subjective. It becomes one of subjective determination. It does not become one of subjective determination immune from objective scrutiny. Another factor that points to the criteria being objective is the requirement that the national prosecuting authority must perform its functions without fear, favor, or prejudice. These three, the performance of functions without fear, favor, or prejudice, were set as the objectives under against which a person in also of the national director of public prosecutions should be judged against, whether they were fit and proper to occupy that office. We conclude all of these court cases here that I've just cited now in this manner to try and advise the committee in the question that is asked us, that the fit and proper person requirement involves character screening of the person involved in the interview you were appointed as a public protector. Honesty, integrity, reliability of a person screened or interrogated to determine whether such a person is indeed fit and proper person to occupy the said office. The committee in this regard will be called upon to objectively make a value judgment on whether a person is fit and proper to be the past protector. it is important to note that the very judgment that has to be made in this instance is not a subjective one, but rather an objective one. This very judgment that has to be made is with regard to the screening of the person to be recommended for appointment as a public protector. It will require committee to inquire whether a reasonable person of that person's qualification and who is meant to exercise his or her powers or perform his or her functions without fear, favor, or prejudice, would have acted in a manner that such a person acted in a given set of circumstances. Whilst the final appointment of the public protector rests with the president, the committee through the process of interviews has an obligation to screen individuals who will be recommended for appointment on whether they are sufficiently honest, have integrity, are reliable and therefore fit and proper to occupy or hold the office of the public protector. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, you've heard, and I think that was quite a good presentation. Are there any questions? Yes, Honourable Member?
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson.
I just wanted to find out why this document's noted as confidential. Really, and it raises a number of issues. I don't think there's any need for it to be a confidential document, but I'm interested as to why the legal opinion is confidential. Then secondly, Chairperson, is it related on both submissions? Because I think a very key issue which we need to discuss will be related to the role of civil society. And in that regard, we were also circulated a letter, I don't know what the status of the letter from Corruption Watch is, where they have asked to be involved, and certain provisions were pointed out where there is a place for civil society, depending on the discretion of the committee. We would obviously involve for their full involvement in this process, given the importance of the public protector in the eyes of the public. It is an issue which then also needs to be discussed, I think. And we would then also like to, we would have a need to have a broad discussion, because there are certain criteria, and we know certain public protectors, and we know the relationship that has existed, which has been hostile to a certain degree between the existing public protector and Parliament. How we address that going forward, we would also need to know. For example, there was a court judgment against the one previous court, public protector, Advocate Mashwama, for not doing his job. So these are all issues that I'm trying to just ventilate. So what do we need to get all the judgments that have related to public protectors to give us guidance as to what has happened in the past? So at the beginning of this process, there's a lot that we need to discuss. And then, of course, the next issue which you'll get to chair is the program. Which one would have to look at whether we are all able to agree on that program. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Hart. Honourable Brayton Buck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm largely covered by Mr. Schwartz in the with regard to confidentiality of the document. I'm not sure what that means. And then I'm very concerned about the fact that there's no provision made in the program or sensitive for public participation. And I really do think we need to ventilate that issue a bit more. I would certainly be in support of public participation.
That's correct. Thank you very much. Honourable Bongo and Honourable Malema after Bongo.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Thank you. One matter I want to talk about will be the public participation vis-à-vis the president, because we're not dealing with the issue of the public protector for the first time in Parliament. So the public participation, as it is raised by the honourable members, I think is generally already covered here, because Parliament has set up a multi-party committee, which is all of us here, which we are public representatives, to deal with this matter. But again, I think the participation in the main of the public will be the nomination process. Once the advert is out, then the public will participate in terms of nominating. But generally, the other matters raised, I think, are generally legislative matters on how the process must run. everything is already covered in the legislation. So from the legislation point of view, I do not understand how would the people participate other than what is prescribed here, forming an ultra-party committee and the nomination process, which everyone will be entitled to as a public to participate. Thank you.
I thought the first thing we're doing was to ask those who presented questions. So I don't see why other honorable members think it is fit for them to answer on behalf of those who made presentations and were asked questions. But that purpose is then informed by the fact that once they've clarified us in our deliberations, then we move from an informed point of view. So I thought this time is directed at those who are trying to guide us here. And that's why I raised my hand. I never thought we're now in that space where we should be amongst ourselves debating what is a public participation and what is our understanding. But I think the point on public participation still needs to be clarified by those who have made a presentation. Is there anything wrong? To what extent can we involve the public participation beyond the traditional way of nomination? The civil society, my colleague, dealt with that aspect much earlier. We see the civil society aspect. What else can we do to broaden participation of our people, despite the fact that when we're elected by them, we then assume that we eat and sleep on their behalf, and therefore the participation ends the day they elected us, which is wrong. So one of the things I want you to clarify, would it be wrong for us to publish after nomination, publish the CVs of those who have been nominated, those who have applied, and for the public to make objections and give us comments if there is anything of that sort, so that we move from a very informed point of view and we don't appoint people who have some issues which were not aware, and had we allowed the public to help us arrive at the best candidate, that would have helped us actually as this committee and ultimately Parliament.
Before I give Ms. Skeen and Mr. Mchengwane the opportunity to respond to the questions, let me just clarify one matter, because raised by Honorable Swart. I have not received anything from Corruption Watch, and although I was advised by the Secretariat that they may be writing to me, but I have not received anything as yet. Okay. I've just received the package now from the Secretariat, and the letter from the Corruption Watch was not yet received, or well, is not yet processed if it is part of the bench, because I've received that now. Okay. The second one is the issue around confidentiality. I'm sure Mr. Mchengwane is going to explain that, because I also don't see why, I mean, case law methods should be confidential, because they are public, and all committees of parliament are public. The members of the public have to be part of the processes, and these processes must be transparent. And I'm here as the chairperson to ensure that this process is as transparent as is possible. So I don't want you to have any notions of this process being, you know, done underneath or whatever. Everyone, the members of the public, will be nominating people consistent with the prescriptions of the law, and they will be, once they have submitted those nominations, we will then, as the committee, go through the nominations. And to, especially on the issues of fit and proper. And I have requested the Secretariat to bring somebody here this morning who is going to unpack the concept of fit and proper. Because as you know, fit and proper tends to be interpreted differently in different professions. And I thought it's going to be important that we get the relevant case law represented to us, which has been presented right now. Without further ado, I'll just ask Christine to respond to the questions.
On the issue of public participation, Ms. Malema is correct that the traditional way of facilitating public participation is through the nomination process, and then also in terms of making sure that our committee meetings are open and that there's a proper communication of what happens within committees to the public through press statements and so on.
I don't think it would be right for me to say whether it's right or wrong to publish CVs for public comment. But it would probably, I mean, it would probably fall within the section 59.1. The only issue that we'd have, that the committee would need to, one of the issues that the committee would need to discuss is whether those CVs are confidential. I think that's all that I can really add at this stage on the public participation.
Thank you, Honourable President Park, I'm so sorry. I saw you, and you will come, Honourable Schwab will come after her.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. First of all, the issue of confidentiality, Chair. The whole principle of confidentiality emanates from attorney-client privilege. And because you were a client in this instance, would require us to prepare an advice for you. We therefore can be confidential because it was for your attention. To the extent that you feel that you must distribute it, please feel free. Otherwise, it is not to hide anything in the person that you'll quote it for this.
Consoir, you may delete it, member. I have distributed to you, so it's not confidential.
And with regard to the issue of public participation, Chair, or facilitating public involvement, this is a legal requirement for Parliament and therefore this committee. The constitutional court decisions on Parliament's obligation to facilitate public involvement. However, Chair, the manner in which the Parliament or the legislature decides to dispense of this constitutional obligation is entirely an issue that members must decide amongst themselves. As it relating to the matter of publishing CVs of people who have applied for this position, that is also a matter that the committee will have to decide after it has deliberated on how best to dispense of this constitutional obligation of facilitating public involvement. However, in law, there is absolutely no bar which we can see now from publishing such CVs. Thank you.
Yes, Honorable
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to add to the two committee assistants' input that there's a court case, Doctors for Life, that strongly recommends public participation, and also the ASMA report, if everyone will recall, strongly recommends public participation, holding the view that public participation makes the process that much more transparent and also binds the appointee to do their job without fear of prejudice, having been strongly scrutinized by also the public. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And whilst I appreciate one normally does follow precedence, but if you look carefully at the provisions of 193 sub 5, and sub 6, there's a differentiation between the nomination process and the recommendation process. Up to now, members of the public have nominated people and then it comes before this committee. But here, we could argue, and I would argue, that sub 6, the involvement of civil society in the recommendation process, which goes beyond the nomination process, would be a strong legal argument that there is a very strong role to play in this, and that only refers to the public protector and the auditor general, which we know have a high threshold of 60%. So that would require a different process and a stronger involvement. That's why I urge that we are on the side of caution reading 59.1A with the involvement of civil society in the recommendation process that's beyond the nomination process, however that will involve, whether it's public participation there, whether it's television coverage as far as possible. So let's err on the side of caution in that regard, because there's a clear distinction between those provisions of nomination and recommendation. Thank you, Chairperson.
Members, I think it's very important at this point that I actually, Honorable Shondo, maybe come before me, then I'll come after you, because I would love to outline the broad overview of the process so that then we can know how best we can take this process forward. Okay?
No, I wanted to say, well, it's the same thing, that we have to be clear when we speak about the public, who else are you speaking about? And what kind of recommendations after what process will have to be examined by the committee and how that will have to take place. Otherwise, we will run the risk of just talking about public participation as some slogan without any meaningful content. So what I'll ask for is that as the arguments are put forward, let's elaborate on them and clarify what we in fact mean and what we expect out of the so-called public out there. Because in most instances, even when we don't speak out the public, we're really speaking about organized groupings from communities out there. In most instances, in fact, the emphasis is on those organizations that have the capacity and so on to make representation fly from all over the country into Cape Town, etc., etc. So we need to clarify that, because the public and what is referred to as civil society organizations sometimes are two different things. So we need to clarify the issues and the thoughts, so that there's much more clearer meaning of what it is that we're putting forward.
Thank you, Honorable Mashondo. Honorable Manem?
I never thought that this level there will be a confusion of what the public interest refers to. I thought that our understanding is very clear, Chair, that in your articulation, perhaps you'll clarify this, that from individual to organized formations, how do we participate in the whole thing? I'm a member of the Judicial Service Commission. We receive any form of opinion from any form of organized formations, including individuals in this country, about stability of certain individuals to be judges. And we look at them. Every piece of input that we receive as a Judicial Service Commission, we pay attention to it, we listen to those inputs in a written form, and we question even those who have applied based on what we have received from individuals and organized commissions. So I'm saying we have a duty ourselves, despite the past practices, to ensure that there's maximum participation by any other person, institution, or organized formation who have interest on the appointment of the public protector. And as a democratic institution, should never feel intimidated, neither irritated by such. And hence the question about the publishing of CVs of those who are applying, those who have been nominated, and inviting individual comments, organization comments, anyone's comments on each and every individual they so wish to comment about. And then from there, the Honorable Committee will then sit down and then take into consideration whatever documentation information they've received and then arrive at the conclusion of recommending a suitable person. Perhaps we have preempted you, and you are going to be speaking to those points as you give us a broad input on what's going to be the way forward on the appointment of this public protector.
Members, I think it's very important that, one, we know the fact that the term of the current public protector ends on the 19th of October 2016. That is the first point. Now, we have to plan our program from the tail end. In other words, we take the 19th of October and you bring it forward. You also know, members, that by the 31st of August, this committee is expected to have submitted its recommendation to the National Assembly. So this specific structure, which is this article committee, is expected to have completed the entire process by the end, before the end of August 2016. And that then gives us the time to say how are we going to break down the time and how best are we going to be involving the members of the public. There is one thing that I must also say to you. This is a national assembly process. And we must also remember that the public participation is not just a nice thing to do. It's in the legislation. That is why this process is going to be very transparent. It's going to be very transparent. And also I must say that every member of society has the right to nominate a person whom they deem fit and proper. But this committee has the responsibility to actually ensure that we put that into the means test. And therefore we need as a committee to define the means test of fit and proper. We've already been given a presentation. How are we going to measure liability? Honestly, in practice, those are the things that we will have to agree on. But over and above that, members, we are going to allow members of civil society to submit questions that they would like this committee to ask to the members, to the candidates, and those that we would have made it to the shortlist. And the process, I must say again, it's going to be very transparent. There is not going to be under-carpet dealings or whatever here. We are subjecting this process to public participation as all other committees of parliament are. And everything that is happening in this precinct, in this parliamentary precinct, is open to public scrutiny because we are public representatives. So in terms of whether we are going to be diverting from the traditional way of advertising or getting the nominations and so forth, or going up beyond just nominating the members, nominating the appropriate person as the public protector, I would open that discussion to members to actually come up with suggestions, and we engage on that. Because some of the things have to be practical as well. We also have to be functional. We also have to understand that we are operating within very tight time frames. We don't have all the time on planet Earth. So we have to take that into account when we come up with our recommendations. And other than just what Honorable Malema is saying, probably we need to go beyond the traditional way of getting the members of the public to just nominations. I'm yet to hear him to tell us what are his proposals. And let's put them on the table so that we can engage on those proposals. And if we agree as members, as the members of this committee, charged by the House, to actually look into these matters, then we will do so. So there is no problem here. Anybody who has a suggestion right now among the members of the committee, they must put those things forward. I must say that, unfortunately, I met with Secretariat on Friday, and I did advise the Secretariat that we will have to deal with the issues of public participation. I also told them that we needed to have the advert being part of the agenda. Unfortunately, I think what they did, they kind of lumped everything together under the consideration and adoption of committee program. So I'm just saying to members, I'm sorry about that, but it's something that I did communicate with the Secretariat that we will have to discuss the modalities of public participation because it is important. In as much as we know that it is in the law and so forth, but I think all the members must be comfortable that the members of the public are involved in this entire process. Thank you. Fun done. Sorry, my child.
I think as a starting point, Chairperson, before we decide what form of public participation we want, we need to look back to when the current public protector was appointed in 2009. What did that ad hoc committee do to conduct public participation? And we don't have to be bound by what they did, but it's certainly good to see what they did. And I don't know if the secretaries can let us know what happened and if we need to take the process a little bit further, but at least we'll be starting from a position of knowledge. Right now, I think there's a lot of ideas in the air, but we don't have the actual facts of how did it happen, how do we improve on it. So I'd like for them to tell us how it happened in 2009.
Honorable Chair, I think that the first point of departure should be the fact that we all know that there's a huge interest on this process, mm-hmm. and we then have to satisfy the expectation of our people by reassuring them, like you did earlier on, that there's nothing that is going to be done under the table. This is going to be the most open and transparent process, and everybody else will be satisfied with this process. And I agree with Honorable Van Damme that on top of the traditional method which applied in 2009, we then say, what is it that we can do to improve that process? And it shouldn't even be a point of contestation or differences. Every time people are encouraged to participate in a process that involves parliament, it should bring about excitement for us, that we are getting as many people as possible to participate. And all are proposing, which is, if it's there, it's okay. The civil society will nominate, will make input, public will nominate, will make input. All I'm asking is that there should be, and it should be a call of this committee, that anyone who's got an issue with a particular candidate should feel free to write to this committee and raise your concerns. And this committee will consider them. That's all I'm asking.
Honourable members, I want this to be systematic now. Honourable Malema has raised the issue of, having the CVs being published or made public to the members of being made public, okay? And I think we will have to discuss that and dispense with that one. But the one that I think we will deal with that one, Honourable Malema, we will discuss that one because I think we need to engage on the particular one. But the one about what actually happened in the previous process, I think maybe Christine, you can assist us there by taking the committee through what actually happened during that process. If there are any gaps that this ad hoc committee identifies, then we can take it from there. Thank you.
Unfortunately, I wasn't involved with that committee. It was an ad hoc committee we were running. The Justice Committee we were running introduced for the South African Human Rights Commission at a parallel time. I can talk probably to the South African Human Rights Commission. We normally just be asked for advertise for nominations. And then it's an open meeting. So there's nothing out of the ordinary. It's really the normal process. I can see if I can track down what happened in that ad hoc committee.
We have an honourable member who was part of that process previously, or in other similar processes. Maybe honourable Nokin, could you take us through what actually happened?
No, unfortunately, Chairperson, I was not involved with that, but I was involved with the Auditor General. That's also a Chapter 9 appointment. But can I was also in a fourth Parliament, a member of the Judicial Services Commission. So I think the honourable Malema has given us a good guidance. You know, we cannot fault the Judicial Services Commission. And I think it is a very open and fair process. So we must start the process at least to get the nomination advertisement out. And we must give good time for South Africa to nominate. And thereafter, our process of public participation will start. I think, you know, if somebody puts his name forward to be nominated, he will probably tell the public. So it's going to be very difficult for us not to make the series known to South Africa. And then, as the Judicial Services Commission, you are free to comment on it. I think that's a very good process to follow. It's proven, it works, and we do get good judges. So I think it's a fair process. So I will support that. We've got a good example. Let's follow that. The public understands it. And there can really not be any objections to that. But we must start the process, get good, reasonable time, and thereafter there will be a secretariat that will do the shortlisting or whatever, and then we can go into the interviews, and then we can decide how we conduct that. But one thing I must make this point, there's no way. Public participation can never mean that the public will do the interviews. That will be us. Like the Judicial Services Commissioners, they will do the interviews, not the public.
Members, I have said earlier on, the members of the public or whatever civil society structures, if they have some brilliant questions that they think we should consider, let them put those forward as a committee, will then look at those submissions that they would have made. But we cannot subdelegate our responsibility to interview the candidate. We have to do that job ourselves. But in the way we are going to do it, it's going to be transparent. I'm hearing Honorable Nick, I think he is supporting Amalema in terms of making sure that the, you know, the Honorable Malema, I did. Sugar, he knows him. He's an Honorable Malema. Now, what's the fun? Okay. So, I think we are going to make this a very, it's a transparent process. And I think as much as possible, we don't want, if we end up with a wrong candidate, then it should be our collective responsibility together with the members of society. Because public participation starts when they have to nominate. They must nominate people that are fit and proper, and they've heard what fit and proper means. And over and above that, they must meet specific criteria in terms of qualifications and experience as prescribed in the law, so that we don't have a problem. So that is the basis when which we are starting this process. The public participation process starts now. It's not going to start when we are interviewing. It starts with making nominations of appropriate, fit and proper individuals to take this position. Thank you.
I think we are making very positive progress, because a lot of what we've covered was covered in the request by Corruption Watch letter, which they used to then to look at, where they asked for CVs to be accessed. And so I think I would support Honourable Malema and Quinoff in that regard, if we allow comments to come in. But the nomination process goes as per course, like we've done. The advert is published as a map of urgency. We've just got to make sure sufficient time is given for responses to that. And then, of course, one can add the public participation by having live television coverage of the process as we are going, whether it's on a parliamentary channel, whatever channel is possible, so that people feel really involved in the process. Chair, you also, so I think we've basically made a lot of progress with the nomination process, but I'd like you to just comment on the program that you are setting out. I think that's the key issue, because we don't want to be forced into, and we've all got elections as we know at this stage as well, but this is a very important process. We don't want to be have something like tied in concrete that isn't flexible, because obviously the 31st of August can be extended if necessary. That's not something we can say won't be. Many ad hoc committees I'm in part of can be extended. We don't necessarily, let's aim to finalize the process, but if there is a reason, and that's what we need to discuss now, with our focus on elections, so much attention is now going to be in July. And then there's a whole process from the 23rd of July to the 23rd of August. One presumes that's when all the interviews will be done. And then from there to the end of August, you say we need to finalize, but from the end of August to the 19th of October, you've still got that process, and it's only the National Assembly. It's not an NCLP process. So that helps us. You can get a motion through quite quickly. But obviously, I also appreciate on the public protector side that you want to have a handing over period, I would think, and that is probably what is envisaged, to try to not have the person appointed at the last minute. But let's just be aware of some flexibility that could be required and that could have the ad hoc committee extended if necessary. I'm not saying it's something we need to decide on, but there is that possibility always.
Honorable Schwartz, unfortunately, you don't know me. I'm more of a technocrat, actually. And when I've been given, you know, time frames, I want to stick to those. Muscle knows with my boss when I was CEO, so you will have to forgive me. As much as possible, I would love us to stick to the time frames that we've been given. And obviously, you've already outlined a very critical process, the handover process and all that. It's very important. And remember, when we appoint a person, that person has to give the notice wherever that person is. And usually it's 31 days, 31 or 30 days or one calendar notice. So we need to take those measures into account. Now, members, I wanted us to be additional. I'm going to give you an opportunity, Honorable Malema. When I give you an opportunity, if you could also pronounce on whether you are in agreement with the ADEC running for 3 weeks, because that is the recommendation that is on the table, which is what you have on your program, the 24th of June, as the closing date for the nominations. If you could speak onto that as well, I would appreciate. Over to you, sir.
No, thanks very much, Chair. I think that there is generally an agreement, but I wanted to come up with something that we agree, firstly, on principles, before we even go to time frames, that there must be a period for nomination which everybody agrees, and that's where the public will make input in a form of nomination. And then followed by a closing date. And then immediately after closing date, Chair, I want to propose that there must be a period for comments and objections. Comments and objections. So, which means immediately when we close the nomination, and we must publish the names of people who are nominated, their CVs must be easily accessible on the website or something of Parliament. I don't know how those things are done. And then there must be that week where people are given an opportunity to comment and object. Objection does not mean a person is going to follow. When a person comes to an interview, I want to put that before that person. Advocate Bongo says he knows you, and therefore he doesn't agree that you are a suitable person to be a public protector because of the following reasons. What is your take? And I can tell you, Honorable Bongo, you are going to appreciate a lot from those comments. Because most of these people, the reality that will be knowing them from the CV only. But if you give other people an opportunity to comment about them, you will realize you are dealing with a completely different person compared to what you see on the CV. I deal with that all the time in the Judicial Service Commission. And most of the things we ask those people is what we get from the public. Now, after that, then we can interview and then make recommendations. Although you are a technocrat, you decided to abandon those other responsibilities and become a politician. And therefore, you must be alive to the fact that in the political agenda now, there is election time. And we have a responsibility to run elections. We have a responsibility to run this program as well. So, in deciding what happens, please take into consideration that we find ourselves in a very interesting period in our political calendar. And I have no problem. 3 weeks, 4 weeks, anything's fine with me as long as we can increase and maximize public participation.
Yeah, thank you. Honorable Bob, you will come after Bongo. I'm noting you.
First of all, I think if I accept the 3 weeks period, the sufficient period from which the public can make a lot of nominations. But one thing that I want members to understand and appreciate is that the process of a public protector, unlike other processes, it's a process that is prescribed by legislation on what terms you must do, what you must follow exactly. So I think Honorable Malema would appreciate if the legislation wanted us to publicize for comments, legislation would have directed so. I want to emphasize that this process is already a public process as we speak, Chair, because Parliament has set up a multi-party committee, which is composed by all of us. It's a multi-party committee. That alone is so to enhance the public participation in itself. And secondly, the public is going to nominate. And the fact that we put an advert calling for anyone to nominate, it is common cause that anyone has a problem or anyone who is not fit and proper may not apply, or anyone who feels that the next one is not fit and proper will raise an issue about it or an objection. Like in any situation I participated in, Honorable Malema, we're doing the information regulator. Because we put in that some attorneys wrote and objected such a certain guy in the address. They said they don't like this one and so on. It's a process that is in the nature of this process itself. So the fact that we're going to be saying everyone, corruption watch will nominate, everyone will nominate, and ourselves as a multi-party committee, we sit down and apply our minds and zero in on every net. So what I'm saying is that there's no need to overemphasize and overraise the issue that a CV must be published. It is common that if you apply or we are nominated, the person we are nominating, that CV has already been published. That's common cause. So the program as it is, I think giving us 3 weeks for nomination process, it will be fine. My only concern is that 19 to 23 is a date before the elections. I think we must just put that date maybe after the elections and put 10 August for this date, so that we allow the process of election to run very properly. And other than that, I think we will engage in this process. The interviews will be live, like all 8 is almost live to any committee. We'll discuss as the multi-party committee on what must be asked. And the public will be interested to hear if there are issues they want to raise, they will raise them through the office of the chair, some of them. If there are questions they want to raise about the particular candidate, that they will do. It's in the nature of the assets that we always take out as parliament. So what I'm saying is that let's adopt this program as it is and just change the 19 to 23, put 10 August. Then by that time we'll be having sufficient time to come back and engage with the interviewing process. Any candidate that will come will be scrutinized heavily. And the issue of fit and proper, I'm also hearing that it is now getting to the light on exactly what it is fit and proper, because some people may understand fit and proper to be something else. Something that we are associated with the ruling party, no longer, we are not fit and proper. So now at least there's a case law that effect that clarifies all the issues. I think let's adopt the program. Thank you.
Members, are we in agreement that Bongo is proposing that we the interviews take place on the 10th of August after the elections. I am very happy with that. However, I think let's try and be systematic, members. First of all, is there an objection on publishing on advertising for 3 weeks? Is there any objection on that?
I don't have an objection with the time period, but should one not also advertise on radios? Is that not is that possible? Or I'm just saying that something we can discuss so that that to be aware that this process is opening. So that is also because a lot of people might not be reading the newspapers in the next 3 weeks. But it is something I'm supporting the 3 week period.
Okay. All right. I understand that the Secretariat is looking on that, and I will also make sure that that is undertaken. So we are in agreement with the 3 weeks. Then there is another proposal that we also need to have, because before we actually, I'm not sure if members would love to receive those applications or those nominations, and before we release them for publication for scrutiny. We don't have to. We don't have to, hey. But, yeah, okay, that is fine. I think then that's what is going to happen. Then we will have to come back, though, you must remember. Once you have, you need to set time frames for that process where members of the public are going to be sending comments or objections. We need to allocate time for that before we also come back for the shortlisting. Remember, before the actual interviews, we must have done the shortlisting, because we won't be able to interview everyone else. So I just want to make sure that the members actually understand. I'm happy with it between the 5th and 7th of July as the date, as the time that we could use for the shortlisting.
Yes, Honorable Kunana.
Can I, maybe, I think we're going to need maybe a little bit more time there.
Mm.
If they want to do the summary and CVs present to the committee, they might decide to include some of the comments, and then that time is too short. So I would rather say we end by the 24th of June, they finalize the summary of CVs. There might be coming in comments all over the place that we do not control or even ask for, but it will be there, and it will be only fair for the committee to see that. So that I would rather suggest that the summary of CV presented to the committee moves to the 11th for 2 days, 11th, 12th and 30th in July, and then obviously in August we'll do the logistics and the interviews after the election. Just to give us a week there, otherwise, because we're moving the end of July to August, so just give us a week there, otherwise we might...
Okay, members, I think we are in agreement in this process. Let me just say to you, if there is anything that is coming up that I am picking up that I think probably you need to know about, I will let you know. But otherwise, I think we can allow more time for the administration because they need to capture all the information that is going to be coming in. Everyone who has applied, they're not going to be putting anyone else aside. So they need to capture all that information. So it's important that we do that. But you must also remember the issue of cost. Say, suppose, I'm not saying it's possible that we can receive 500,000 applications. Now, but I'm saying in the event you receive such a lot of applications, obviously you also need to put the cost factor in there. And Honorable Nalema Odoa, I'm a politician, really now. You know that technocrat thing is still lingers with me. So cost is very important. So we will have to look at that as well. But we are not going to do that at the expense of the public participation process. That is very important. Now, members, we've agreed on that. I just want you to look at this advert and see if you are here with us. Do you have something else on our side?
I think there's a step that's missing in the program. From the point of the closing date of nominations, how are the members of the public going to know that the persons have been nominated to be able to comment? Now, that is from that step, because the next step then is the finalizer. Is the secretariat then going to advertise the lists of names and CVs before we then meet? Because it's normally at the point where we then discuss the summaries that we would need the comments. And that's the Judicial Services Commission model, if Mr. Malema is correct. So at some point, the members of the public are going to need a list of names and the CVs or something along those lines.
Honorable Swan, do you have a specific suggestion?
Yes. As soon as possible after the closing date for nominations, and when that final summary of CVs is received, that first July, we need to advertise a list of names, so that the public know these are the nominations that were received. You may comment on that. We need somehow to let the public know that, because otherwise it's only going to take place at the point when we're considering the CVs, and then we need to have the comments at that stage. Unless at the point of considering the CVs we then allow another period. But I think before that, when we have the list of nominations, we should publish a list of these are the names of the nominations, and maybe with just an ID or something like that, so that people are aware that these are the people that have been nominated. Because to publish all those CVs would be very costly.
It would be very costly indeed. Yeah. Oh, Honorable Matondo?
Honorable Matondo? I'm largely covered. All I was going to really request for is that we know the proposals that have been made up until now, and we give you a broad mandate to adjust the program accordingly. And that's on this question of advertising of names and so on, that we look at the feasibility of that, and when the moment comes, we do as indicated.
Okay, Honorable Mala?
I agree that we don't do the CVs, but you know, it's a very simple thing. Once we close, names are compiled by our admin, put on our website, and then you can, not even have it, as press statement. Nominations have closed, and those of interest, please visit our website. These are the names. You'll find the names of nominated people. If you have an objection or any comment to make, you can then submit that to the following address. Not advert, a press statement, and then sending them to the link, and then we'll meet. And then when the CVs are being prepared, it then helps also the admin to say, Mr. Malema has been nominated, but the following comments have been made about that person. So you can even attach, depending on the capacity of our admin, you can even attach whatever comes with the name of Mr. Malema, comment, whatever, and give to the members, so that when we do the shortlisting, we move from a very informed point of view. I've never been a technocrat, neither did I work anywhere. This is my first job. So I don't know those things. But what you do, you can try and minimize costs like that, as long as we don't go beyond our budget and create the wrong impressions here.
Thank you. I think that is in order. Members, I think we will do as much. And also, just to remind members, we have HP, so that is also going to be used to publish the name. And we will also make sure that as much as possible, you know, the process is open. Members, I just wanted you to just okay this, so that we can dispense with it before, because we've dealt with the program. Yes, Honourable Ngotabo.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson and Honourable Members. According to me, the advert looks fine. It's very much commensurate with the provisions of legislation. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Ngotabo. There, we, because we're supposed to find a light commonly 3 weeks, so we are going to put the date. If you could kindly put the date now. There's another thing that is important, members. Remember, we've just been speaking about nominations. Will we accept applications? Remember, there are people that are going to be nominated and they will be supported, but other people may wish to apply without being nominated. They probably see that they are fit and proper and they meet the requirements and they want to apply. Okay? Yes, Honorable Matapo.
What is the law saying? Is it saying that people should be nominated? Is it giving allowance for people to apply?
Maybe help us there. I just want to be sure. I don't want to... Yes.
Nowhere in the Act or the Constitution would say around the process of the nomination, the committee nominates, but not around the... It doesn't say how the CVs or the applications come to us. So I don't think there's anything that would prevent an application.
In other words, the others... I think then our address must be specific. It must say nomination or application, okay? So that people don't feel like, you know, I need to be nominated by somebody. No.
I'm not getting the
No, let me explain. This committee is the one that will be nominated, the final nomination that is going to go into the National Assembly will be that person that would have been through the scrutiny by this committee. So there is nothing necessarily wrong in law for somebody to put forward an application. If that person we feel as a committee is good, we may nominate that person. Remember, we are not going to be appointing the public protector. In fact, even the National Assembly is going to be voting on the nomination from this committee, and the president will be making the appointment. But we must remember, it needs 60% of National Assembly. That's how important this position is. Okay. Thank you. Is that
clear? Sir, they don't need 6%.
No, Malema, no. You know, Malema, that zero is very important, very, very important. Don't look down upon that zero. members, the other thing that Bonani here is just reminding me that we will have to include in the advert that Dafidis will be subject to public scrutiny, so that we are not found wanting somebody, because this is a public process, so we will have to include that in the CV. Members, I don't know, I think you've done pretty well. I was worried when I saw Honorable Malema coming in, because I said, uh-oh. Okay. But it was not that
bad. The most progressive MP.
Anyway, I'm okay now, because we've been able to finish the business of the day. And members, let me once more thank everyone and appeal to all of you that are here that this process is beginning, and in fact we are going to see this advert going into the weekend newspaper from this weekend, and want to make sure that all the relevant, the best person for the job gets this job and get the word around out there, so that we can get the best public protector. Already the public protector that we have has made this office so known. I mean, it's very known, and people know the importance of this office, and that's all work together in getting that best person for this position. I thank the members. The meeting is adjourned.